This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello, and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, going through changes, shapeshifters in myth and speculative fiction.
Now, I'm not going to lie, this episode is entirely influenced by the fact that Jules has been forcing me at gunpoint to Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
You didn't need that much convincing.
I really didn't. I recently finished Next Generation, so Jules was very, very excited about me watching Deep Space Nine, so I started watching it, and I've absolutely fallen in love with it. And Jules has been living vicariously through me the first experience of watching Deep Space Nine, and living vicariously through Jules is her partner.
Yeah, Alan and I are basically just living for the sort of the daily morning and evening DS9 updates so that we know where you've got. It's really sad.
My favourite thing about all of this is that at one point Alan asked you, has she got to this episode yet? Jules and Midge said, no, if she got to this episode, she would have absolutely 100% have mentioned Will Riker. And you were right, because the moment Will Riker appeared on the screen, I was like, Will Riker!
Yeah, I just got this message saying, Riker's in this one. I'm like, yep. Caught it. Anyway, we will get to our favourite shapeshifter towards the end of the episode. But first of all, we thought we hadn't actually really talked about shapeshifters or shapeshifting in general. And obviously, it's one of those things that it sort of crosses borders in terms of pantheons and different types of folklore and mythology. Almost every pantheon does have a shapeshifter myth attached to it, often several.
Yeah.
And I can't believe we haven't really covered it before, to be honest.
Yeah, absolutely. Shapeshifters are just a really interesting subject in general. And as you say, they appear most mythologies in some form or another, but they also, as well as appearing in fantasy, they hold a very specific place in sci-fi as well. And so they are one of these figures which actually really do cross genre borders with relative ease.
Yeah, absolutely. So why, whenever we find basically an archetype like this that crosses continents and crosses different cultures, there's usually some really compelling reasons as to why it captures the imagination. So yeah. What's the appeal of shapeshifting? Well, one aspect is this sense of the other. You've got someone who appears human and is very much definitely not. And some of the most menacing, horrific sort of folkloric stories are the ones which feature shapeshifters. The shapeshifter is never usually the main character, it has to be said. It's usually somebody having to encounter them and defeat them.
Yeah, absolutely. And this the thing that always kind of amuses me is that shapeshifters tend to, that there tends to be two kind of ways that they're presented. They're either presented as being a devious person or a devious creature which has ulterior motives and which relies on trickery of some kind. You have those kinds of shapeshifters. And then you have shapeshifters who are incidental shapeshifters. In other words, they have enormous powers anyway, and they can shapeshift, but they tend to be quite stupid characters in mythology, in that they are the ones that they act through force and might rather than trick.
Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose the part of the appeal is, when we talk about shapeshifters, a lot of it is to do with the fact that the person shapeshifting starts off looking human and is able to either take on an aspect of an animal or completely transform into that animal.
Yeah. Or the other way around, where some creature which is not human at all is able to transform into something that is human or resembles a human.
Yeah, so there's obviously a big, big sort of melting pot of different myths and things to draw from, and we're going to sort of dip into how it's been used and look at some specific myths and things. One I want to touch on is, it's going to sound weird when I say it, but follow me. Follow me down the rabbit hole. shapeshifters and puberty. There is a huge connection between shapeshifting and puberty. I wonder why. Both in myth and in speculative fiction. And I think it bears a bit more close examination. Obviously, you're literally going through changes at puberty. It's usually quite an uncomfortable experience, no matter what gender you belong to. And it interests me that, you know, even in folklore and things, particularly if we're looking at women in folklore and they're talking about women sort of reaching the age when they can start to have children, the parallels there between women and, say, werewolves, or, you know, being able to transform into things like does and hares and things, there's a huge body of lore there.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, there is so much lore there that I think we're probably going to have to limit ourselves to talking about shapeshifters who can transform into multiple things rather than shapeshifters who can only phase between one form or another. I mean, I think we'll probably touch on that anyway, certainly in terms of discussing puberty, because I think you're right. There is this big link, and it is a fantastic metaphor to kind of look at the changes of the human body. But be here for a long time, so we're probably going to have to come back to this subject.
We'll choose the isolated examples. As a converse, I recently read a book called Silver Moon, and I'm sorry, I can't remember the name of the author. I think it's an indie published book, but the main character reaches menopause and starts going through changes, because, again, as a woman, you go through changes once you hit menopause. Or, you know, right. as someone who owns a womb, you go through changes when you hit menopause. It's an unfortunate side effect of having a womb. But she starts to find that she's losing time. And then the other women are kind of gathering round her and being extra, extra supportive, but in a weird, creepy, watchful way. And then when the full moon comes, she's like mid-stride with her menopause, she turns into a werewolf. So it's one of those things that once women have reach the end of their fertile active life in this town, then they tend to get called as guardians, and they kind of get this extra lease of life as werewolves, and it's an entirely female werewolf pack, and they're all menopausal women. I love that. I think that's such a great—
that's amazing. I love that. That's brilliant.
So that's Silver Moon. That's a really, really good book. Catherine Lundoff, I think the name is the author. So, yes, so the parallels between shape-shifting and the hormonal changes of your body are obviously quite an interesting one.
Absolutely, yeah. I think there's also ties in with identity as well.
Definitely.
And the idea of kind of the outside reflecting the inside. Let's have a look at some examples of shape-shifting. Let's start with mythology. And then kind of go into fairy tale and folklore, and then sort of fiction. Mythology, I think, is an in for shapeshifters, because, as we said, shapeshifting appears in a lot of mythology. However, in some forms of mythology, you have gods who are able to shift quite at random into pretty much whatever they want. Sometimes they have to use special tools to do it. And then in some other mythology, just using magic, people can shapeshift. For instance, Celtic mythology, early Celtic mythological cycle, you left, right and centre, the Tuatha De Danann are just turning themselves into shit, often to escape things.
Or turning other people into things. And usually when they've turned someone else into it, then you've got... the devil's own job to get them transformed back again.
Yeah, absolutely.
So if you're thinking of, for example, the rivalry between Cléna and Avel, Cléna and Avel were goddesses of different parts of Ireland, and they both at one point desired the same man. And the man, quite strangely, chose Avel over Cléna. Cléna, who was the goddess of love and beauty, did not like this very much, so she turned Avel into a white cat and imprisoned her in a cave.
That's nice. Isn't that nice?
And the man being a man, sorry, that's rude, sorry. The man being the man in this kind of particular folkloric tale was sort of, well, the one I really wanted has run off, but the goddess of love and beauty still wants to sleep with me, so I guess I can't be that bad. Starts an affair with Cléna. And then he hears the rumours of a beast in a cave, so he goes to find this beast, and there's a little white cat there. And he goes in and sort of like, obviously he was a cat guy, because he kind of goes, oh, you're such a cute little white cat, you're a little white fluffy thing. And he pours some goat's milk from a flask into his hand, and the cat laps up the milk and turns back into this other goddess. It tells him everything. And he is so incensed that Cléna took his choice away that he leaves her. But Avel won't take him back because she absolutely refuses to share a man with her rival.
Yeah.
So he tries to escape over the sea, and Cléna's like, well, nobody leaves me. Seriously. She's got a real prima donna thing going on. Nobody leaves me. So she calls up a great wave, because being the goddess of love and beauty, she's also a sea goddess. And drowns his ship.
Yeah, they show love in a weird way, don't they?
They really do.
So left, right and centre, you've just got the Tuatha De Danann transforming into animals, sometimes objects as well. And there is, you know, talk of the fact that they're in pretty much most pantheons. You have this mixture between animal and humans, or not humans, but the humanoid forms that have animal aspects. A lot of this people think are linked to hallucinogenic drugs, which are basically the foundation of humanity. The people have been taking drugs for an incredibly long time and using drugs to have visions or et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and using them as the basis of mythology, stories, things like that. Even our perception of the world from our ancestors has a lot of drug use involved. So I'm really not surprised.
Are you thinking of flying ointment?
Yeah, among other things. Yeah, we're flying ointment, where you weren't actually flying, you just felt like you were.
Well, the flying ointment was also used for shapeshifting, allegedly. And it's a mixture of henbane, wolfsbane, and deadly nightshade. Guys, don't try that one at home. Seriously.
Yeah.
All of those are really, really, really poisonous. Don't even pick them.
You could look on the internet.
But yeah, the idea was you put on a wolfskin belt or a wolfskin cloak if you happen to be fancy, and you rubbed this ointment all over yourself. Now, that must have made your skin burn. And then when the drugs enter your system, because without going into the chemistry of it, basically once it gets into your bloodstream, as well as being a neurotoxin, what it does is it speeds up your heart rate, it causes relaxation of the involuntary muscles, so your pupils would massively dilate. And you probably saw some really strange shit. You probably did think you were turning into a wolf or whatever. So that, coupled with a sort of mental preparation, would have made you act very oddly indeed. Again, don't try this at home.
Again, inspired by drugs, but also because, particularly again in Celtic mythology at the very least, and several other mythologies, you have this great relationship with nature and with animals. Moving away from Celtic mythology, I want to look at some of the gods who could change form.
Before we do that, can we just... can I just mention the story of Little Gwion?
Oh, absolutely, yes.
Because it's just Welsh mythology. It's Welsh mythology.
Marriage.
Marriage. Oh, God, don't say Ceridwen, the goddess of death, change, transformation, and magic in general, had an argument with Little Gwion. Little Gwion was the son of another goddess, and it depends which source you go for, but he stole something from her, and that's not something you do with a goddess. That's a bad idea, generally.
Terrible idea.
And they end up in a contest of magic. I don't know if you've ever seen the Disney Sword in the Stone, whereby they have a wizard duel, but I think they must have based it on that story where with Little Gwion, because what they do is they take it in turns to transform themselves into things in a sort of like rock, paper, scissors of who's going to win.
Mm-hmm.
And they go through all these different animals, and Ceridwen's always just slightly ahead, but Little Gwion is quick and his magic's good, even though he's half human. And then he turns himself into a hare to avoid her. She turns herself into a sparrowhawk, almost catches him. He panics and turns himself into an ear of corn. So she turns herself into a hen and eats him.
And eats him.
Well,
sorry,
yeah,
I didn't hear the end.
To be honest, if you're going to turn yourself into something that can defend itself, an ear of corn is probably not the way to go.
No, probably not a great idea.
I mean, what are you going to do? Give them a gluten allergy?
No gluten for you!
I've always kind of liked that one, although I'm not sure why, because it doesn't have a happy ending.
No, but... I do like that. It's interesting because you get that in folk songs as well. There's a particular folk song, what is it, about the lusty smith going after a woman, and she keeps changing into different things. And it's a really rapey song,
yeah,
to be honest. But I've heard a great version where she gets her revenge on him and she hunts him down instead at the end of the song. And he keeps trying to escape her and she just doesn't let him escape. So that gave me a great sense of satisfaction. But yeah, it's the idea that you don't just turn yourself into an animal, but you can turn into anything, into any kind of inanimate object. But this is actually something I want to touch on, which is that there are kind of different ways that you can shapeshift. There are different ways you can shapeshift. Now, it can be an illusion, or you can actually become the thing. And in terms of becoming the thing, I want to talk about Loki. Because really, we can't talk about shapeshifting without mentioning Loki.
We're obviously going by the Norse mythology here rather than the Marvel character.
Yeah, not the Marvel character. Though, of course, he's also a shapeshifter. But again, Marvel characters, that it seems to be illusions, really.
Yes.
Whereas in the original mythology, Loki is an actual shapeshifter. And when he shifts, he actually does become that he's shifted into. It is as real as any form is. You know, you could question, what is Loki's actual form? Now, even though I think this is a power which other members of the Aesir actually had as well, Loki in particular is the one who is known for using it. And now it is quite interesting because obviously you have there's this kind of disparity between how he has this ability to shapeshift and what he can shapeshift into. For instance, at one point he borrows Freya's cloak of feathers, which allows him to transform into a bird. And she has this cloak, which, sort of lets her transform and lets her fly. And yet, weirdly enough, there are other points when he will just transform for pretty much no reason. For example, transforming into a mare so that he can lure away a horse.
Yeah, so he could lure away the giant's horse, which was building the wall. The Aesir didn't want to pay the giant for his work. So
yeah,
this idea of not paying for good work you've received, it goes back a long way, clearly.
Yeah, it does. And they get away with it, which is the problem, really. But not only does he lure away this horse, he then gives birth to a foal, with 11 legs, as you do.
I thought it was 6 legs. Sleep
was it
near.
6 legs? I thought it was 11.
Sleep near has 6 legs.
Does he have 6 legs? I thought it was more legs than that. It's more legs than the usual number of legs for a foal.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a many-legged foal. Is it 7 legs, maybe? I thought it was an odd number, and that's what always got me, was the fact that it was an odd number.
Well, perhaps they were counting something that wasn't actually a leg.
Possible. Anyway, so he produces this child, this foal. This is not the only monster that... I say monster. That sounds rather mean. It's just a horse. But he produces other creatures.
Yes, he fathered Hel. He also fathered the Jormungandr, the world serpent, and he fathered the Fenris Ulf.
Yes. So now, sort of like, I think two of the children that he fathered looked humanoid in most adaptations. One is Hel, who again looks sort of humanoid. Unless you look under her skirt. The second was the child born of his Aesir wife, whose name I forgot. Pretty sure he gets murdered, though, so that's fun. But otherwise, yeah, he just was producing these children were not humanoid at all. And the question of what kind of form he took when they were conceived remains to be seen. And also, actually, I think he gave birth to a few of them as well. So he is this shifter, and he doesn't just transform to kind of into monsters, but animals as well. So he transforms into the horse. He transforms into a fish and tries to swim away unsuccessfully, because I'm pretty sure Thor catches him and then ties him up with the entrails of one of his sons and, you know, has him tortured for the rest of all times before Ragnarok. So that's fun. But again, yeah, it's this weird thing of why then did he need Freya's cloak? And is he the only one who can shapeshift in that pantheon? Because they can certainly guises, but he seems to be the one who can very physically become something else at will.
Yeah, I think you're right. Obviously, there is a massive amount of material missing from Norse mythology. There are some myths we've got fragments for, and we'll never really know what the actual myth was.
Yeah.
So a lot of it got lost. But yeah, he does seem to be the only one who absolutely does completely change into whatever he's chosen to turn into. And it's interesting that he not only changes into it and changes gender, because a common thing with shapeshifting seems to be that you keep the same gender.
Yeah.
But he changes gender so completely that he can act as both a mother and or a father.
Yeah.
So he can reproduce as either. So that's really interesting, the fact that he is so completely gender fluid. It's not completely unusual in mythology, but it's unusual that it survived, so it must have been pronounced enough in enough myths that it survived the Great Purge.
Yeah, that it stuck around. Similarly, and again, Loki is a trickster character. Similarly, if we go over to Egyptian mythology, I mean, the Egyptian pantheon are just all over the place in terms of what the hell they look like. What are their heads? Who knows? Are they half animal? Are they not? We don't know. But certainly they could transform into animals sometimes. Set, for instance, and Horus, when they were battling, I seem to recall that they both transform into animals at some point to fight each other.
Yes, although no one really knows what Set is. It's a bit dog-like, no. And yet not.
Yes, Set is just a notorious cop. That is his creature. That's what animal he is. He's a dick.
Okay. While we're talking about gods, let's look at a few shapeshifters who go from animal and disguise themselves as human, but they are in fact, you know, their general starting form is animal. One of my favourites appears in lots of Native American myths, and that's Coyote, who I'm mostly going from Navajo and Hopi myth because I'm much more familiar with those ones, but I understand it, Coyote is a big god and appears in lots of different ones. And there's various different legends. One of my favourite was how the story of how Coyote made man. Coyote was the trickster god, but he was part of his trickster ability was the ability to create both things and situations. And allegedly he sculpted, allegedly all the animals were quarreling with each other to the point where Coyote just got fed up with it. Mm-hmm. So he took mud from the riverbank and he shaped a man and a woman and he set them above all the other animals. So there's one creation type myth for you.
Yeah.
But he's a really sinister character. He spends a lot of his time walking around looking like just an average man. And what he does is he sows discord, because out of the discord and the conflict come new beginnings. But it doesn't feel like that if you're the one being tricked.
No.
And whenever he gets caught, he's punished. He's punished really badly. He can't die, but he can definitely suffer. There are stories where he's lashed down in the tundra while crows peck him apart and feast on his eyes and things like that. And the stories are really, really disturbing. And yet Coyote takes a certain delight in recounting them to people. The stories are that if you happen to be making a campfire out in the middle of nowhere and a stranger comes in and sits by your fire and offers to tell you stories, there's a chance it might be Coyote. And he will tell you horror stories that will keep you awake all night. And he won't stop. You can't get him to stop. You just have to survive and not run away from the campfire. So, yeah, I really, really like the character. But he's very sinister and not entirely understandable, I think, to a Western viewpoint.
That's a great... I've never heard of... Never heard of him.
Obviously, he spends a lot of time as a coyote as well.
Yeah.
And I think there's some mythology about how you're supposed to always be polite to coyotes, even if you're driving them away from your kills or whatever, because you never know which one might actually be the god.
Coyotes can tiptoe, though.
Yes.
That's an odd fact that I just find terrifyingly kind of cool. It's the fact that coyotes can tiptoe. I can kind of understand this idea that maybe that's something which understands human nature or has kind of like human qualities, so is more than just an animal.
Yeah, definitely. Moving from coyote back to, well, it's been embraced in sort of Mexican and South American myth, but I think it belonged to the Native American tribes who were there before, and it's kind of been adopted and changed. Mm-hmm. And this is the sort of shapeshifters who are very, very disturbing. You'll laugh when I say it. There's supposed to be shapeshifting roosters and donkeys and jackals. Now, roosters is kind of like, until you think of, like, actually, they're quite vicious.
No, I have a healthy fear of chickens, to be honest.
But these shapeshifters, they're not gods. They are supernatural creatures, and what they do is they use their animal form to lure in unsuspecting women in order to rape them.
Yeah.
So they're really disturbing. And then you have things like the chupacabra.
Yes.
Which doesn't have a definite beginning form, but is considered not human at its initial starting point. It can take human form and it will trick you and it will try to take your children because that's what it eats. And there are varying different myths there as well, which also intersect in with each other. And the sort of the general term for these is sort of, in Native American terms, is skinwalkers. Which you've got to be a bit careful because there's a sort of spiritual sacred element to the skinwalking as well as the really sinister myths that have also been adopted as well. So
yeah,
I'm going to stay off the stuff I don't really understand, but
now, you know, skinwalkers, as you say, has got that very, there's a big spiritual element as well. I think that the concept of what people understand of the skinwalker, I mean, the concept of anything which specifically takes on different forms in order to lure you away is so terrifying that I'm not surprised that lots of people like to use it in fantasy.
Yeah.
But of course, it comes with the fact that there's this massive misunderstanding of a huge spiritual and cultural thing that goes along with it, and people have just kind of appropriated it, which again, you don't really need to do, because as we've established, shapeshifters exist in pretty much most mythologies in some form or another, and two of them are nefarious.
Yeah, they're absolutely endemic. I mean, you've got the Pooka in Ireland,
yeah,
which generally appears as a horse but can take other forms as well, and shapeshifts in order to lure you in.
You've got Kelpie as well, another horse.
Yeah, mostly stays as a horse but can appear as a person, a human.
Yeah.
You've got the loup-garou in France, which isn't just a werewolf, it can take other forms.
Yeah.
And okay, I'm going to say this because the etymology bugs me, but people say werewolf. Okay, that's fine. When people say were something else, again, that's fine. And then people say, oh, well, they were a were. And I'm like, okay, what you're actually saying there, that were is an Anglo-Saxon word meaning man. So there's an entire series of books about a teenage girl werewolf, and it's called Weregirl. And I'm like, so what you're really saying is man girl. Do you realize man you're saying girl. Man girl? Do you realize that? And it kind of bugs the hell out of me. And the thing with were is actually a gendered term in terms of etymology. The word man, which we took from the Anglo-Saxon word man, actually just means human. It can mean man, it can mean woman, it can mean either. But were literally means man. It means a male. So anyway, okay. I had to get that out.
Little history lesson there. Little. I think again in French mythology, and this actually appears in a lot of fairy tales as well, is ogres. Or giants who are able to transform. And I think that's probably tied into Celtic mythology as well.
Yeah.
A great example is Puss in Boots.
Yeah, that is a good one.
It's a fantastic example. And I remembered Puss in Boots because actually, weirdly enough, they use a similar story in DS9, which we'll get to later on at one point. when they're challenging one of the shapeshifters there and they're telling a story about a shapeshifter. Now, Puss in Boots, there is this Marquis character who he's an ogre, he's a monster. Everyone sort of lives in fear. And the puss is able to trick this ogre by basically sort of appealing to his vanity and saying, oh, you know, I've hear that you can transform. And so the ogre transforms into these amazing, monstrous creatures. And Puss says, oh, that's very, very impressive. But actually, it must be quite easy, you know, to transform into something so big and vicious when you yourself are so big and vicious. I bet you can't transform into something very small. And the ogre goes, ha, of course I can. And transforms into a mouse.
Puss in Boots being a cat.
The cat goes, nyam, and eats him. And they all live happily ever after. So, you know, a man was murdered and eaten, which is not fun. But hey-ho. And the thing that all... And I think this is weird, right? Is that... Every time I heard that story, all I could think about was, where does the rest of the mass go? Like, how does it work? But where does it shrink? What about the rest of the atoms that make up the rest of it? Where does it go? And I was genuinely concerned about. And it's something that bothers me every time you see shapeshifters who have like a human form, for instance, who their regular form is a human form. And I always think, how can you transform into something smaller? Where does the rest of you go? And in fantasy, it's this kind of, okay, it's magic, so you can sort of understand it. But sometimes in kind of sci-fi or superhero, for instance, when they're able to change and it's them physically changing, it's not just an... I get really, really confused and annoyed with it.
Well, there are gaps between atoms. So if
True.
You were able to manipulate matter to the point where you could control the spaces between atoms, then in theory you could make something that was very big, very small.
But what about the electrons, Jules? Electrons can't occupy the same space. They get.
You wouldn't have to. Again, you've got space between atoms. Anyway, this is getting ridiculous, but we don't have to solve this, and it's kind of against our remit. But yeah, basically, there are spaces between atoms. That's the short explanation. I won't go into the chemistry.
Or still physics. Not convinced, but okay.
I will send you diagrams later.
If anyone else is curious, leave us a comment, and I'm sure Jules will share her scientific understanding of shapeshifters with you as well.
My theories.
Your theories.
Okay.
From right, all the studies she's done.
Before we go on to our favourite shapeshifters in speculative fiction, I just want to look at one of these other phenomenons, which is phenomena, isn't it? Phenomena, not phenomens.
Phenomena.
Sorry, right. Shapeshifting and sex. No, and I don't mean that in a weird or kinky way. I just mean a genuine. Okay, I cannot be the only person who has noticed the huge swathe of paranormal novels out there which are billed as shifter romances. And they all pretty much have the same plot, you know, it's a slightly overweight girl and a, but she, you know, she's really clever, etc., etc., except that probably never appears on page. And this super, super hot washboard abs type man who happens to be a dragon in his spare time or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it just goes from there. And it's an excuse for a steamy novel. And by the end of it, you know, they've decided that they're in love with each other or what have you. And that's not to say that these things can't be fun. Definitely. But why is there such a big draw to that? Is it the idea that if you want a steamy read, then you can have something really unrestrained if you've got either one or both parties exhibiting animal characteristics?
Okay.
The thing is, this does have its roots in mythology as well. That there are most definitely myths and things whereby a shape-shifting god or what have you does not bother to turn back into his human form before making sweet love.
Looking at you, Zeus.
Today I think I'll turn into a swan or a shower of gold or a dolphin.
It's always the dolphins or the bulls. Big thing about bulls, isn't it? Yes. Anyway.
Without getting into the unsavoury details, what is it? Is it in mythology, obviously, it's a case of we need to capture these aspects within the human psyche to display. Therefore, this will explain it with the parents. I'm not sure how well that holds water, but I think that was the idea. With these shifter romances, is it kind of like, this is unrestrained sex you'll never get bored of because, hey, he might sprout wings at any point?
Honestly, I'm not sure what it is about it. It might be, I think, yeah, as you say, there's this unrestrained part of it. It might be this sense of the wild, as it were.
Yeah.
Something. God, I don't know. I don't really understand it. List, but it might also be about kind of indulging these fantasies about the ultimate sex, as in things which are absolutely not possible, but you kind of you want to envision. So the size of certain body parts, for example,
the improbable size of certain body parts.
Size, the enormous size, the unbelievable size of certain body parts, which again, don't really understand, because to be honest, A Court of Thorns and Roses. The size of the body part is often, there's this whole joke about wingspans. With Illyrians, they have wings, right? And apparently, you know, the size of their wings is meant to dictate the size of, you know, other important male parts of the anatomy. I say important male parts of the anatomy, you know what I mean. We're talking about dicks. And there's just this whole thing about the fact that Rhysand has a huge dick. And it goes on and on and on. And the more it went on and on and on, the more I could just think was, that sounds so painful. It sounds so uncomfortable. And to be honest, being reminded of animals, every time you talk about having sex is weird for me.
Well, yeah, I mean, obviously we haven't done one of our bad sex award episodes for a long time, but the one that we did do, we talked a lot about all the animal imagery, and that was what was making it really awkward.
Yeah. That being said, I think that part of kind of the appeal of this whole shapeshifter thing, as I've said, is the idea that you can appeal to certain fantasies, but in a very, very safe and legal way, and to say, oh, I want it would be great if humans could do this, and now I have the ability to make that physically plausible and physically possible in a situation whereby that kind of thing wouldn't kill me or wouldn't cause horrific injury or trauma.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, sort of sitting here thinking about it, there is also the aspect of most, because most shape-shifting type books and speculative fiction start from the idea of the werewolf, which is probably the most well-known shapeshifter in mythology and folklore. They immediately go to, well, is a werewolf like an actual wolf, in which case does it mate for life, and therefore do all shapeshifters sort of fall into this? Once they've found their mate, that's it, that's the one true soulmate, and there's no one else. And there's an element of that in there as well. So it's kind of like this epic wilderness style SAS survival sex, and the idea that this person will never leave you.
Yeah, I think also there's a lot of it to do with perceived behaviour in animals.
Yes.
So, gosh, this is a very protective animal. This is an animal that, you know, will growl and bite and has very forceful sex for life, so is deeply romantic. Or, you know, a lot of these ideas of this is what animals are like. And now I'm really laughing because, of course, it's usually really noble animals, but can you imagine if it wasn't, like, ducks?
Yeah. In case you don't know this, ducks male ducks seem unable to tell if a female is dead or alive if she's just lying still, and will have sex with a dead female duck.
Yeah, well, and to be honest, there's lots of things about mating ducks which is gross and really wrong,
which
and
we,
rather
we
nasty,
won't actually get into.
Which we're not going to get into.
But duck necrophilia is pretty out there.
It's pretty out there. It's pretty gross. But yeah, I do think there does tend to be this kind of look on particular animals. And wolves are a big one of that, but big cats as well. Things that basically we see as elegant, dominating, fierce, strong. You kind of want to have those sort of attributes. And you use that by actually using an animal who's not actually an animal, is a shapeshifter instead.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Okay, let's look at some of our favourite shapeshifters in actual speculative fiction for the last few minutes.
Yeah, sorry, I'm actually kind of really the other topic behind. It's okay, so our favourite shapeshifters. Okay, we'll get to Deep Space Nine in a minute, because I think we're going to want to chat about that for a few minutes. I think probably it goes without saying that if I put Loki aside, because I do love Loki, again, from mythology as a character, I think he's brilliant. One of the kind of the first shapeshifters that I really sort of was introduced to was Mystique from the X-Men.
Yeah.
Mystique is a really, really interesting character, and obviously in terms of the films which have come out recently, Mystique has had this very big journey where she's gone from being a villain or you know a kind of a mutant terrorist, as it were, to actually being more of the secret operative who's actually on the right side of things instead, and she's become much more. But in every incarnation, she's a deeply she's a very layered character.
Yeah,
that doesn't change the fact that she is vastly there for a great deal of titillation. Let's not lie.
No, she. I mean, okay, I love the films, but she is largely walking around in a thick layer of makeup for most of them.
Yeah, you basically, she doesn't wear clothes really at all, especially in the originals. You know, she's just kind of in her skin, and obviously every time she changes, she will mimic clothes. And again, it's this strange thing in that she's able to physically become someone down to the very, very last detail, but she isn't actually them. And it is still kind of an illusion. For instance, when she changes into Wolverine, her claws, she gets the claws as well, but they are not made of adamantium. They're just kind of regular metal, and they're able to be cut off. Similarly, if she changes into other mutants, she doesn't gain the mutant's power or ability or physical, you know, abilities. So she can mimic the way that they look, and she can mimic the way that they and to fingerprints, I'm pretty sure, to a very, very high level. And again, she's able to kind of make herself very small or very large or completely change her shape. And I never understood it, but there you go. She's able to do all of these things. And I really loved that because I love that power. It just seems wonderful, actually. I would love to be able to shapeshift just because great. Imagine the cosplay, Jules. Imagine the cosplay.
Yeah, that you'd be sorted for Halloween forever, wouldn't
I
you?
I would be so sorted for Halloween. I'd have the greatest time.
There are two I really like. If you've ever read Octavia Butler's From Seed to Harvest series, Wild Seed, the main character Onyanwu has the ability to shapeshift. She can do it by imitating initially. But if she actually wants to change herself down to the molecular level, which she can do, she has to have ingested part of the animal that she turns into. So in order to sort of make her shape-shifting abilities better, she sort of eats a bit of dolphin or a bit of leopard or whatever. She only needs a little bit, but it's teaching her cells what they need to mimic in future. So yeah, that's a really interesting one. They're great books, great science fiction, sort of, but set African set books. Mm-hmm. That I would highly recommend. Another favourite shape-shifting character is from the October Day series by Shannon Maguire, and it's Tybalt. Tybalt is basically all the characters in the October Day series are fairies, so of one kind or another.
Yeah.
Tybalt is the king of dreaming cats, so he's king of one of the fairy courts, and all of the members of that court are shape-shifting cats, and by cats I mean sort of they're fairly large domestic cats, so when he shifts he turns into a tabby cat.
Aww.
But you know, they're really, really dangerous as well. They can walk through the shadows just like you'd expect a cat to, so they can just sort of materialize wherever they want to, and he's just such a great character. Once he starts developing feelings for another character, he just gets more and more Shakespearean in his declarations of love. And it's hilarious and sort of really cringeworthy.
Aww.
We find out later on that this is because he actually knew William Shakespeare and may have had a little bit of a thing with William Shakespeare back in the day.
He is called Tybalt, so...
Yep. That's where he took the name from.
That's amazing. In terms of other characters, I just kind of want to mention two honorary sort of mentions of other shapeshifters. So obviously we have Mystique. Going on into DC, away from Marvel, we have two shapeshifting characters. We have several shapeshifting characters. One, of course, is Martian Manhunter, and his niece Miss Martian. They are from, you guessed it, Mars. And they can shapeshift. They can shapeshift, which is like shapeshifting, but it a day in London every time. And they, sorry, my brain has just kind of gone to one level now. I am not functioning.
It's because I mentioned dragon shifting romance, isn't it?
Yes,
it's my fault.
Yes, it is. That is exactly why. Thank you for that. You made it especially weird because I've kind of started a story which is like that, but not like that. That's all I can think about, so thank you. anyway. so you have Martian Manhunter and Miss Martian, who have these telekinetic abilities, but they can also physically shift into different forms. They can, and it seems to be that they can actually change into more than just animals, but into other things as well, including mythological kind of stuff. So unlike Mystique, who seems to only be able to kind of create humanoid forms, Martian Manhunter can turn into a giant snake, for instance, and other things as well.
Yeah.
Then, of course, you have Beast Boy, who is very easy to spot because he's entirely green, and Beast Boy can only change into animals. Which is again a little bit different. I also kind of want to mention from my own books, Fae as well.
Yeah.
Now Fae is obviously, she's a catchy, so she is able to transform into a giant winged cat, as one does on a Wednesday afternoon. Small confession there. That's what I do on my Wednesday afternoons.
I think everyone knew that.
Oh, okay. The secret is out. Don't let the government know. I never really thought of her as a shapeshifter because I always thought of shapeshifters as someone who can transform into multiple things. But actually, the more we've talked about it this today, I've realised she is actually a shapeshifter. So does that make me? Does that make me one of those authors, Jules? If I pair Faye with someone, does that make me one of those authors?
How smutty and graphic and animal related is the sex going to be? And please don't answer that.
Let's just say if Faye is going to have sex with a human, she will do it in her humanoid form. There will be no shifting.
Yes. One last shapeshifter I will go on to before we talk about our absolute favourite, joint favourite, and that is Varala Dana Sarasri from Tamora Pierce's Wild Magic series, the Immortal series rather. And Dana starts off as someone with just a bit of a knack for animals who doesn't know who her father is. And as the books go on, she learns more and more and eventually learns that she can turn into different animals. She can't. It's not just that she can talk to them, or that they will do what she says. And then as you get further on in the series, you realise that her father was actually Wirin, the hunt god. And that's the reason that she's got all this strange wild magic, which allows her to shapeshift. And it's just great. It's really, really interesting. Obviously, a lot of thought has gone into and research into how animals behave and things has gone into the books, which I really appreciated. It's not just, oh, you can turn into a wolf, you can turn into a bear, and then they don't ever bother giving the species characteristics to the character. Tamora Pierce has actually really, really done them. And it's a lot of fun. It's kind of like, wow, if I was going to have powers from one series of books, that would be a really good power set to have.
That is a very cool set of powers.
So, our favourite one, which obviously we mentioned at the beginning of the episode, so probably you've worked it out if you're a DS9 fan.
Yeah. We are, of course, talking about Odo from Deep Space Nine.
Lovely, lovely Odo.
He's so wonderful. I do love the character of Odo. And the nice thing is that he kind of actually explains the whole size transformation thing for me, because Odo's natural form is not humanoid. Odo's natural form is, drum roll, a liquid.
Yes, is it a gelatinous blob? And it's for something that is so, I mean, really, he would technically be overpowered because he can become anything in theory. But the fact that he can only hold it for certain amounts of time, and he must revert to his gelatinous form. He must take corporeal form, and he must go back to being a gelatinous form. Otherwise, his cells start to deteriorate, and he can get really, really ill.
Yeah. And the thing I really like about Odo is that Odo right now, in his arc, where I'm at, I'm on season three, is sort of exploring the extent of his abilities. And it's sort of explained that when Odo was found, he was just this gelatinous form, and they figured out that this form was alive, but they didn't know that he had intelligence. And so in order to show that he had intelligence, he was just in a beaker on a table. And the scientists came in one day and there were two beakers. And that's how he demonstrated that he had intelligence, was by mimicking things around him to basically show. Some things are easier for him to mimic than others. For instance, he can transform into a rat, into a very convincing rat, which he does at one point. He transforms often into sort of inanimate objects in order to spy on people and to get up to no good, like tables or chairs or glasses or things like that. There is just this very funny scene where Quark, who's kind of the local criminal, the lovable criminal, is just hitting various things in the room to make sure none of them are Odo, just in case. But Odo still struggles with the human face.
Yeah.
Or rather, humanoid face. So he looks a little strange. But he kind of seems to pick other things up quite quickly. The thing that I really liked, though, is that most recently he started to sort of explore the idea of not just turning into this thing, but actually being it, understanding what it is, sort of exploring textures as well, which I thought was brilliant, is that they start to talk about the texture of something and trying to become different textures, which I just thought was fantastic. I really liked that.
Yeah, his character arc goes in some really interesting places, and just the whole general what am I shape-shifting thing. I mean, by human terms, I think he's sort of about 50 years old, but in changeling terms, he's a child. He's basically a child. And I don't want to say anything spoilery, but he's just this great tragic hero character. He really is.
Yeah, he is. He's this kind of this brooding with a heart of gold, I think is the way that Jules described him. Was he's a very grumpy man. And also another thing is that quite interesting, because actually his real form is just this gelatinous pool, he doesn't eat or drink. He doesn't actually have a mouth or eyes or anything like that, so he doesn't technically see through his eyes. And he's really fascinated by food and by people eating food and by the preparation of food. And the thing is that because obviously he spends a lot of his time in his humanoid form, you forget that he's actually, that's not a natural form. It's just the one he's taken up in order for people to be kind of comfortable around him. And so there is this great scene where the Cardassians take teeth from everyone that they, that goes through their system. They take a tooth for whatever bloody reason, Cardassians being Cardassians. And Odo's just there like, well, I don't have any teeth for you to take. And I was like, you're right, Odo, you don't actually have any teeth for them to take. And I do genuinely wonder what would happen if someone tried to kind of take out a tooth. Would it just turn back into the gelatinous form and flow back into him? I don't know. I kind of want to find out, if you cut off his arm, what happens? I'm very interested.
You will find that out. You'll be pleased to know.
Yay!
Yeah, and I think what I find so interesting is he's he is about as alien as you can get from the other characters. He's not humanoid, he's not solid, he's not mammalian or anything like that, and he takes a form that other people are mostly comfortable with. And yet, despite being such an outsider and the only one of his kind, he, you see from the other changelings, is not innate. This is stuff that he's learned. He's overcome his quite difficult beginning.
Yeah.
And he thinks of himself as much part of them, a part of the people in the station around him. In fact, more so than he does anything else. It's such an interesting character journey, because what's your frame of reference? Can you look at somebody else if you're literally, your cells do not function in the same way? Can you look at somebody else, even though you don't have eyes, and genuinely really form a sincere attachment to them?
Yeah.
Because what is your frame of reference? It's just, okay, for me, that's a bit mind-boggling. And I love the fact that that's kind of what happens. Because he must be seeing way, way below skin level. He really must.
It's brilliant. He's a fantastic character, incredibly lovable. And I think one of the most wonderful things about Odo is that he's very human. Despite the fact that he's absolutely not human at all.
So, I mean, I think when I was nagging Madeline to start watching DS9 for over several months, I was doing this.
Yes.
And I think I was like, no, but you have to see Odo. You have to. If you don't love Odo, I'm going to be distraught.
I think we've run out of time, Jules.
We have. We have come to the end of the episode.
Before we go, it is time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation of the week. And Jules, have you got one for us?
Yes, I'm going to talk about a series which I've come to quite late. It's by Libba Bray and it's called The Diviners. It's not a 70s rock group, I promise.
Are you sure?
It's definitely not. That's The Divinals, isn't it?
Okay.
80s, not 70s. It's called The Diviners. It's set in 1920s New York, and there are four books. The fourth book is coming out very, very soon, so you could hop on the story now, and by the time you've got read through the first three really, really big books, you could get the next one, which comes out in November, I believe. The first book is called The Diviners, and the main characters, there's lots of different ones. It's fabulously diverse. It's quite queer in places as well.
Hello.
As part of the diversity. Our entry point character is a girl called Evie O'Neill, who is a flapper. She's a 17-year-old girl, and she has this ability to read objects, as in really reads people's secrets from objects. She gets herself into trouble in Ohio and gets sent to her uncle in New York. Her uncle keeps a folklore museum in New York, and things just kind of gradually start to get worse. And then she meets other people who, at this precise moment, I'm halfway through the second book, they don't all know that they've all got different powers. You can tell that they're going to have to do some kind of Avengers Assemble type thing where they all start working together and admitting they've got these powers.
Yeah.
But right now, they're not doing it. And it's both frustrating and wonderful, the time taken and the research that's gone into the history and everything. And it's just a brilliant series. if you go for the audiobooks are read by January Lavoie and they're absolutely phenomenal. So I highly recommend those. Basically, if you've enjoyed my Unveiled series, you'll really like these books. And if you really like these books, you'll probably like my Unveiled series. By extension, you'll probably like Madeline's Urban Fantasy series when it, you know, finally emerges. Anyway, I really recommend the series. It's really good. Don't expect quick answers or a linear plot. It's not. It makes you think. It makes you work for it. But they're such good books.
I will put those on my list.
Yes.
And on that note, guys, we'll say thanks very much for listening. Do leave us a comment telling us who your favourite shapeshifters are, or whether you agree or disagree with us, or even whether you have any comments about sexy shapeshifters. Until then, keep it PC, guys. Until then, have a good week, and we'll catch you guys next week. Bye.
Thanks and goodbye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons.
the Speculative Fiction Podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders, or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note that no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.